This is an audio recording taken from the Daru Advocacy Sector Conversations Forum held on Tuesday, the 2nd of September 2014 at the Queen Victoria Women's Centre.
I'm very pleased to introduce to you our session two of today's Advocacy Sector Conversations Forum. We'll hear from Kenton Miller, who is the Education Consultant at the Victorian Equal Opportunity and Human Rights Commission, and he's going to be in conversation with Trevor Carroll, the Executive Officer of Disability Justice Advocacy, and they'll be speaking specifically about how to make representative complaints. We'll be allowing for question time towards the end of their presentation, so have your questions ready, and just to remind you that as we are recording proceedings, it's really important that you do speak on a microphone. So raise your hand when you do have a question later on in the session. And as you've probably guessed by now, with Natasha and myself both being vision impaired, we need you to be verbal when your hand's up, or else we can undertake Kenton's direction as to where we put the microphones. I'll hand over now to Kenton. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Thank you, Robin. Kenton Miller, if you ask talking to me, I answer anything vaguely down the Brenton-Clinton end. That's absolutely fine. I'll begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we're meeting and paying respects to elders past and present, of course. Very pleased to have Trevor Carroll with us here today. Trevor and I have spoken for a while about the need to do a session on representative complaints. At a certain point, co-presenting shifted because I just said, look, it'd be much better if I can just turn into Parkinson and interview you, because he's full of it. That is information, skills, hot tips, everything else. So Trevor's been very kind to be able to share his insights, and I think hot tips is the best way to put it, because he's got some insider trading secrets about how to develop complaints or write letters in such a way that they will get read and acted upon. I might even ask him a question he's not prepared for later, which is about what his success rate is. Let me just say that before we do that, I'm going to talk a little bit about the law and how it works. For those of you who have endured or enjoyed my training sessions beforehand, prepare to sign up for what will either feel like a wonderful refresher or something you can claim frequent fire points for. Okay. We're going to talk a little bit briefly about what the aims of the law are, particularly how the unlawful behaviours around disability get connected to, because although I do train about the Charter, I'm mostly going to be speaking to the Equal Opportunity Act today, how people can prevent complaints from happening, which is a core part of our business, not just dealing or responding to complaints, but hopefully supporting people to make sure they don't happen in the first place. And then we're going to talk about our dispute resolution model, and I'll use that as a segue to start interviewing Trevor about his experience of using our dispute resolution service and what's worked for him in our service, but in other services as well. Because I think the word serial complainer would be an unkind definition. Let's just say extremely successful and strategic complainer. All right. Why we have the Equal Opportunity Laws, in brief, is that they're there to eliminate discrimination, sexual harassment, and victimisation. And victimisation, although it's a word we think of as being about bullying, is actually about protecting people's rights to make complaints. One of the first times I met with Trevor, he was talking about a woman who, in regional Victoria, who had been, as part of her home care, been put under a shower by her carers, and they had failed to test the water first, and that had led to severe burns, and it took him a while to persuade her that in fact she could advocate for herself about her treatment. And usually it's the same reason. It's the fear of, if I make a complaint, they're going to take that service away from me. So the need is to reassure people that they cannot do that. There is a law that prevents them from doing that or punishes them if they do. We encourage the identification and elimination of systemic causes of discrimination. So where there is something in place, a system that contributes to it, the new Equal Opportunity Act works far more effectively in trying to get people to address those before they become problems. Of course, the Equal Opportunity Act works hand in glove with the Charter now as well, because Section 8 says that under recognition and equality before the law, discrimination is as it's defined in the Equal Opportunity Act, and we facilitate the progressive realisation, which sounds like wonderful legal language, but it means that it's not all going to happen tomorrow, but we have to be committed to making sure the day after tomorrow is much better than yesterday. So, unlawful behaviours. We have an instant checklist. It's about discrimination, sexual harassment, and victimisation. We're not going to go into sexual harassment too much today. We're going to focus on understanding discrimination, both direct and indirect. Direct is unfavourable treatment, which could be being bullied or harassed, being denied a benefit or opportunity, or they offer you that benefit or opportunity on unfavourable terms. So the private landlord might say, yes, of course, we'll rent the house out to you, but because you're a single parent, we're going to charge extra bond money. That definitely triggers the definition of unfavourable treatment in one of these areas of public life. Employment, goods and services being almost anything you can think of. Education from kindergarten all the way up to tertiary. Local government, all the parts that don't provide services. So when you think about things like home and community care, they definitely fall under goods and services. Accommodation is a sheer joy for a lot of us who deal with people who might live in group homes and so forth. Sport, everything from amateur up to the big leagues. Clubs have a new definition for those of you unfamiliar. 30 or more people, partially self-funded, and they have to have a liquor licence. So it's a very concise, precise definition that a lot of clubs now fall outside of. And disposal or sale of land. And those are the wonderful 18 protected attributes. These vary as you travel across the land. There's about 12 protected attributes in New South Wales, about 8 in South Australia. There's a number that are protected on a federal level as well under the Australian Human Rights Commission. And one of the questions we sometimes get is, should we make a complaint through the Australian body or through the Victorian one? What's the difference? Ring us. Our goal is to make sure that you get a good outcome. It's a myth to believe that if you go through the larger body, you'll get a larger payout. That's not how it actually works. It's more about how disability is defined under each of these acts. And at the moment, Victoria has the broadest, most generous interpretation of how disability is read. So, for example, if there's a disability issue inside of employment, our law in Victoria says, are you able to fulfil the genuine and reasonable requirements of the job? At federal level, it's the inherent requirement, and that's a much higher bar. You and I don't need to hold this stuff in our heads that much. Well, I do, because I have to bang on about it all the time. But sorry, George? I said, we don't have to hold this inside. About the interpretation is that on a federal level, it's the inherent requirements of the job, which is a much higher bar than genuine and reasonable requirements. So you don't need to memorise that, but when you ring our people, they'll... yeah. They'll step you through it. So if you need clarification, ring our inquiries line and say, because that may determine why you make a complaint through Victoria rather than through the federal body, because you go, actually, it's easier to meet the bar here in Victoria with that complaint. Okay? There's a range of other attributes there. We'll skip intersectionality for now, except to say that... a person with a disability is also a person with a whole range of other attributes as well. My goodness, they even have ages and physical features and sexual orientations. Who would have thought? So you can see from our list there that the area we've gotten the most complaints under is disability. Yep. You win here and you win nationally as well. Disability is always top of the pops, unfortunately. And there's a whole range of reasons as to why that is, not the least of which is magnificent disability advocates. I'm going to dig down into the complete definition of disability just so that you can see it covers total or partial loss of a bodily function, such as a broken arm or being vision impaired, the presence in the body of disease-causing organisms, such as HIV or hepatitis, total or partial loss of the body, missing a limb or a finger, malfunction of the body, including mental or psychological illness. That's really important here in Victoria, where that isn't covered under the Disability Act, Discrimination Act, the Victorian one. It's covered under the federal one, but not the Victorian, and so it's led to all kinds of interesting things happening with the NDIS rollout. It means that we do get complaints around equal opportunity. In fact, last year, of the complaints we had in the area of disability and employment, a quarter of them were related to mental health issues. A condition or disorder that results in the person learning more slowly than people who don't have that condition. Malformation or disfigurement of part of the body. A quick example of this, when I was training people up within the prison system, is that they had a prisoner who'd been shot in the face and was disfigured, and they kept moving him into solitary confinement for his own protection, and that's not what we would consider to be an effective way of supporting someone sometimes in the system. Just one of the many fun issues that prisons bring forward. And an impairment that may exist in the future. And an example I might use there is Prader-Willi disease, where you lack the capacity to stop eating, and that counts as a genetic predisposition towards morbid obesity. This has become a crucial one, which is behaviour that is a symptom or manifestation of an impairment. The biggest case related to this that was semi-resolved last November was Mr. Slattery versus the City of Manningham. Mr. Slattery is the fund customer of the kind that you might be familiar. He was diagnosed with acquired brain injury as a result of a stroke, has hearing impairment, and also has been diagnosed with bipolar. Mr. Slattery was actively engaged in council affairs as a member of the community. From council's perspective, he was someone who liked to ring and complain, hurl abuse over the counter, ring up and scream swear words at staff, etc. They found someone who could work well with him for a while. When that person left, they weren't able to get a replacement. What happened is that they sent a couple of people out at one stage to visit Mr. Slattery, and they came back to the office and said he threatened to chuck bricks at us. And the City of Manningham bosses went, oh, well, that's occupational health and safety, really, isn't it? Okay. So they declared that the way to deal with this was, in terms of occupational health and safety, we'll make our staff nice and safe. They declared Mr. Slattery to be a non-person. Mr. Slattery was no longer allowed to visit council, ring them, write them letters, use any council facility such as the swimming pool or the public library, was unable to be actively engaged at all. This continued to be so for a couple of years. When the Equal Opportunity Act got souped up so that behaviours associated with a condition was included, Mr. Slattery reapproached council and said, can we please revisit our understanding? May have used more terms than that, but that was the gist. And they said, no, you've had your chance. Now, that was crucial when the case finished up inside of VCAT, because the judgment was, as a public authority, which local councils are, as well as every state government department, you need to consider a human rights-based approach to this work, and that means considering the human rights of the people who raise complaints and issues with you. You cannot say, that's too hard, we're not dealing with it. The judgment was really important because it said every single one of Mr. Slattery's behaviours was directly related to his disability. That was the crucial part. So everything that they had presented as being vexatious or foul-mouthed, being able to directly relate it to his bipolar condition, his ABI, meant that they needed... He didn't win a brand new car. He didn't win hundreds of thousands of dollars. He won the right for the City of Manningham to go back and revisit how they're going to work with him. And that's where things are at the moment. they need to find a way to work with this ratepayer of theirs rather than just create him in a non-person category. Okay. Also protected is any assistance aid that a person with a disability has. That means anything that a person with a disability needs to use to function is the same as other people. A chair that a person's in, a hearing aid, an Auslan interpreter, and every assistance dog is now protected in Victoria. Assistance animals have been protected for a while under federal law, but that's only if they've been trained at certain institutions. The assistance aid legislation here in Victoria is much more generous. It just has to be a dog that has been trained to deal with or respond to your disability. So we haven't had test cases around this yet, but I've argued with the lawyers lots because I've been doing lots of work in homeless shelters and out there in the community where people have various dogs that they use to assist them with their disability. And the checklist is this. Does the person have a disability? Is their dog trained? Does it aid or assist them with their disability? Then that's it. Okay? Happy to support anyone who's had difficulties around this. Please talk to us or ring us on our inquiry line. The question is, does the dog have to be trained by a particular person or through a particular agency? The answer is, although nothing I say can be taken as legal advice, merely information upon which you may choose to act later, the best information that we have to hand is no. If that dog has been trained, even by its owners, to respond to the person's disability. So two quick examples, a woman in a large motor scooter who has her chihuahua travel with her because it calms her nerves for her anxiety condition so that she can travel out of doors, counts as her assistance dog. And her doctor has made a little card up for her. If you have regular clients, you've got a good GP, doctors can get a card made up. Not having a card doesn't prevent you from being able to claim this. I was doing work up country recently. There's a bloke whose wife is epileptic and their 54-kilogram German Shepherd is trained so that whenever she has a seizure, the dog lays down alongside her and licks her face until she comes to. He said, it's an amazing thing to see. The only people who are unimpressed are the Ambos because they get a bit frightened by, you know. Okay. Direct discrimination then is exactly that. Unfavourable treatment because of a protected attribute in an area of public life. And a quick example is Vicky having diabetes, who's told she can't work as a paramedic, although she has a medical certificate to prove she's never had a hypo and that her diabetes poses no threat to patients. That would count as direct discrimination. Indirect, it's this lovely letter of the law, a requirement, condition or practice that disadvantages a person or group of people with a protected attribute and it's unreasonable. So they didn't build the stairs to keep her directly out. Indirectly, the stairs discriminate against people with mobility issues. Or an advertisement for a job as a cleaner that says you have to have VCE level English is going to count as indirect discrimination, possibly on the basis of race. Preventing complaints. Employers and service providers have an obligation to provide reasonable adjustments for people. So any adjustment that's needed by a person accessing a service or wanting to do a job that enables them to do that job, that they can do the job with that reasonable adjustment, is required under the law. So Toby has recently been prescribed antidepressants that leave him sleepy in the morning. He needs to start work late for 2 weeks while he adjusts to the new medication. That's actually a reasonable adjustment because of his antidepressant medication and it's protected under the law. The preventative framework says that organisations must take reasonable and proportionate preventative measures to identify and eliminate. That means we don't wait for complaints anymore. We actually need to have our organisations and services up to scratch under the positive duty to be accessible and not discriminate. For advocates, it's a really useful thing if you don't want to wait for a complaint. You can become an ally to the service by suggesting that they may avoid complaints in the future by realising their obligations under this. External complaints, if you've got one, can be taken to us at the Commission or to VCAT or the Australian Human Rights Commission, who are not a competitor of ours. If you make a complaint to them here in Victoria, it gets heard in our rooms, where they're a big sister organisation to us, or the Fair Work Commission, where it's related to such matters. Our dispute resolution service, and this is where the segue begins to Trevor, is free, flexible, fast, and I wish voluntary was like an F word as well, but you know. Conciliations happen as soon as possible. There used to be a lengthy investigation process that's no longer there. And we provide an inquiry line. We really do have people waiting to take your calls. Nearly half of those calls come from service providers or business owners or managers checking in with us. What we're doing, is it okay? Are we able to do this under the law? So please do ring and avail yourself of our services. You may now complain directly to VCAT. Under the law, you had to go through our entire complaint system first. Now you can take a complaint directly there. I'm actually going to park the conciliation stuff for a moment and then just go straight on to talking to Trevor about it, because that might be a better way to explain everything that there is. Now, are these hoping that these are both on? Oh, brilliant. Trevor. Hearing loop okay? Good. Can I ask, first and foremost, what's your success rate?
Pretty good.
Yeah?
Yeah, no, I've lost count, but it's over 100 different complaints, disability discrimination complaints in both the state and federal human rights commissions. And that's personally for myself as a person with a disability, and I haven't lost any of them, so it's 100%. In terms of lodging complaints on behalf of clients at Disability Justice Advocacy, in the last five years, we've probably lodged, I don't know, 40, maybe 50. We probably get about anywhere between 8 and 10 a year, and we've only lost one in all that case. And that really wasn't our fault, I've got to admit. It was largely because the evidence that the client insisted on that we present on their behalf as part of the complaints process just didn't wash with VCAT after it had gone to the Human Rights Commission. Mm. So it was a mental health issue as well. And this particular person just couldn't see that their particular evidence wasn't relevant to their complaint, no matter how much we tried.
Yeah. Can I just check, is Trevor's voice coming through loud enough for you? I can move the microphone a bit closer. Okay. Thanks a lot. So, Trevor, let's start off right at the beginning. What is a complaint?
Well, first of all, it's got to be in writing, and that's the main thing, which poses problems for people who are non-verbal, who can't speak and, say, get on the phone and ask for help from the Human Rights Commission to actually write the complaint. It also raises issues for people who have physical disabilities. For example, cerebral palsy, who can't actually manipulate a pen or a keyboard and type for themselves. It also raises issues for people with intellectual disabilities who can't write because they're illiterate. They don't know how to do it. So that's where the role of advocacy comes in. In my experience, carers in the private sector, particularly family members and so on, often don't have the level of experience and knowledge and training and understanding and skill to be able to lodge a complaint on behalf of someone. They generally speak the expertise of an advocate of some kind. However, there are a lot of workers in the sector, particularly disability support workers, who realise that there is a complaint of discrimination. But because they're fearful of the repercussions in relation to their own employment, they often make a referral on behalf of a client anonymously that has been discriminated against, because they don't want to write it up as an incident in the group home, for example, or the shared supported accommodation. So they'll make a referral to us. It's probably a bit close. They'll make a referral to us, and we will investigate it and lodge a complaint on their behalf. But the important thing is, it's got to be in writing. And the Human Rights Commission here in Victoria offers a service to help complainants actually write the complaint if they can't write themselves, or, as in often happens, that we get referrals from your team, Kenton, a lot to actually do complaints on behalf of clients that ring up.
So what would be your hot tips? There's a number of advocates in the room who might find themselves in a position where they're writing a complaint on behalf of a client. What's your insight into what's the best way to write that complaint so it gets acted upon? What increases the chance of that happening?
Yeah, well, look, I think one of the big successes we've had at Disability Justice Advocacy, we've actually got a policy about systemic advocacy, which involves writing representative complaints on behalf of groups of individuals that have a common issue. And also, as part of the agreement that a client signs, or their carer or their support person or legal guardian signs, when they sign up for our advocacy service, part of the agreement is that they allow us to achieve a systemic outcome at the same time as we try and solve their individual problem. So it gives us that power when we sign up a client to say, okay, we'll fix your problem, but we're going to make it better for everybody who has a similar issue. So we do that. That's one of the first things. The second thing is that you need to write to be read. And by that I mean that there's a particular skill in writing these complaints so that the respondent, the person you're complaining about in terms of discrimination, for example, actually wants to come and try and solve the problem. So that's the skill, being able to write it. Okay? Because the consequences of it not settling through conciliation, through voluntary conciliation in the Human Rights Commission, is that you've got two choices. One, you can either just drop the case if you can't settle it, or two, you go to VCAT. And a lot of people a lot of individuals with disabilities are very fearful of VCAT because it's a tribunal and they don't often want to get tangled up with solicitors and things that the respondent might be putting up to protect their interests. But at Disability Justice Advocacy, we don't often go to VCAT because we, generally speaking, settle them in conciliation. So the skill is in writing that application so that the respondent wants to come and solve it. And part of that is leaving some little tantalising gaps in the submission that you write, the complaint that you write, so that the person you're complaining about or the agency or organisation that has discriminated against you actually wants to come and hear and find out what's going on. And that's an important skill. So writing to be read, the person who's reading it wants to actually come and try and solve it. They don't want to go to VCAT.
Sorry, we're just pausing while George is grabbing the microphone.
I'm really fascinated by that concept. Are you able to provide an example? Because although I understand what you're saying, I don't quite understand how it would work in a real-life example.
So what George is asking is there a concrete example you can give to illustrate that as an approach? De-identifying, of course.
Yeah. Okay. Give you an example of an issue that I've just recently settled in relation to a personal complaint about an accessible toilet in a licensed gaming venue that's locked, and it's immediately adjacent to a male toilet and a female toilet for able-bodied people. They're unlocked, but the accessible toilet in this public gaming venue is locked. There are no signs on the door to say what you have to do to get a key. There's nothing at all. And so I made some inquiries because I needed to use that particular toilet and went straight to the bar manager there and said, how come the door's locked? Why can't I get in like everybody else can get into their toilet? He said, I don't know, mate, I just work here. That was his attitude. It's policy, mate. Here's the key, bring it back. Yeah. So I wrote the complaint based on what he told me. And the fact that I concentrated on the relevant sections of the Equal Opportunity Act that related to this particular case, the fact that a lady went on the way to the toilet, actually stopped and said to me, what's the problem? And I explained to her. She said, I think that something's wrong with the door. It looks like the lock's broken. I said, no, it's locked. And she tried to solve, and she said, that's disgraceful. So that went in the complaint, all using very simple language telling it from a first-person point of view is really important when you're lodging a complaint. That's very important. It's very powerful to do that from a first-person point of view. And citing the relevant sections of the Equal Opportunity Act that relate to it. Don't get distracted by minor details when you're writing up the report, such as whether the, you know, what the weather was like when you arrived or what time you left home. None of that's really relevant. What is really relevant is what happened at that particular time to you and how you felt about it. And that's really important. So use the KISS principle. Keep it simple, stupid. That's what I always try to use. Keep it simple.
Can I just yeah. ask... You rush past there how you felt about it. How important is it to show the emotional impact of the incident?
Yeah, look, it's you can. It's really good to use words like, I felt humiliated, I felt ignored, I felt unwanted, I felt like my money that I paid at the bar wasn't as good as someone else's who was able-bodied. So using those sorts of terms, so start with I feel, use that assertive response, I feel like this, this is in relation to this particular incident. I felt embarrassed when the lady stopped me as I was going to the toilet and said, what's wrong? You know, those sorts of phrases, I feel humiliated, I feel upset, I feel angry, I feel sad, I feel ignored, all those sorts of phrases are really important when you're lodging a complaint, because that will tend to make the bar manager or the owner of the premises the next time think twice about locking that toilet, because they can see what effect it's had on you as a person. Now imagine if you were incontinent and had continence issues and you desperately needed to get in that toilet. You could also make the point that, you know, if it had been another 2 minutes, you might have been mopping the floor as well and providing me with a taxi to go home. So really appeal to the respondent's emotions by using those powerful emotive words, I feel, and starting, I always start with I feel. That's a good tip for you there in relation to that. And it's important to explain when you're doing that what the respondent's actions or inactions did to you. So is it something they did that caused you to feel this way, or is it something they didn't do that caused you to feel this way, that they should have done? So it's really important to get the difference between those two things done. And the other thing then is to indicate what you want done to resolve the complaint. And I always give the tip that you need to number them. Very important you number them. Don't dot point them, number them, because when you get to conciliation, you get to the point where you've told your story, and then, you know, you get to the stage where you say, what do I want to do to solve this problem? You can point, you can articulate by pointing to the particular numbered responses that you've given in relation to what you want to solve it. Things like, for example, you want a donation to charity. You know, I want the door left unlocked. I want other some form of reasonable adjustment, such as if you're going to lock the disabled toilet, I want you to lock the able-bodied toilet and the female able-bodied toilet, and just see how many complaints you get from the rest of the customers who come into the premises. You know, you won't last long. You'll be out of business if you lock the toilet. So they're the sorts of things that you need to do. And don't make any outrageous demands or threats. Like if you ask for a donation to charity, for example, don't ask for, you know, $10,000 to VicDef or something. You know, a modest... I never put the amount in any of my complaints. I just say a modest donation to charity. And if you feel particularly humiliated and embarrassed by what happened to you, then you can ask for a personal gesture of goodwill from the respondent. Now, I found that particularly useful. I've had free airline trips around Australia. I've had, you know, $200 or $300 worth of free taxi vouchers, all sorts of things, goodwill gestures, as a token that the person that has caused this problem for you is really genuine and wants to make amends for what they've done. Getting them to admit that they've actually discriminated against you is extremely difficult. I've only ever had it happen to me once in the whole time. All the complaints I've ever had, I've only ever had one respondent that's actually said, I'm sorry I discriminated against you. Everyone else says, I'm sorry about what happened to you. I wish it had never happened, and we'll make sure it doesn't happen again. But to get them to actually admit discrimination is not easy. They don't like it. They don't like to do it.
There's a particular phrase, isn't there, that they use where they'll give you the gesture of goodwill but wipe any future liability out so you can't make...
Yeah, and quite often they'll want a confidentiality agreement too, particularly if any donations to charities are involved, or if there's a gesture of goodwill or anything else like that, they'll often want a confidentiality clause. In fact, one of the things that bugs me a little bit is the standard conciliation agreement that the Commission uses actually includes a confidentiality clause, and I try to avoid them if I can, because it restricts the systemic outcome. If you've got a confidentiality clause, you can't tell all your friends with disabilities and the whole disability sector that this is what you can expect when you go to that place the next time, or use that service the next time.
Trevor, can I just hold you there for a moment? I think George has another question.
I just wanted to affirm what you're saying about the importance of, well, for me, when I've made complaints, that face-to-face experience and conciliation is quite important, because previously you're just a name on a complaint, and then they meet you and you tell them what happened and how it impacted on you, and that's a chance for them to really understand that the discrimination is a problem. And I had this experience where I'd asked for that personal gesture of goodwill, and they said, well, you know, what do you want? We need a figure. I said, oh, $1,000. And then they said, oh, can we give you $2,000? So, you know, they really got it and they wanted to make up for it. And that was only when the face-to-face thing happened. Mm. While it was in letters and in, you know, written correspondence, they were making all sorts of excuses. So it's a good opportunity to put it to them.
I'm going to use your question as a segue, George, and say if we're talking about conciliation, if you've put the complaint in, then what suggestions would you make to the people in this room about how do they prepare for that conciliation then? What are the steps they need to go through?
Well, first of all, you need to let the conciliator know if you have any special needs for either yourself or for your client that you're representing in the Human Rights Commission. Things like hearing loops, like armrests on chairs, like plenty of room for a wheelchair, those sorts of things, whether you need to have plenty of fluids on hand, such as water and so on, whether you need regular toilet breaks, whether you need an interpreter, whether you need Auslan, whatever. So it's important to, as part of the preparation, to let them know, because there's nothing worse than turning up to a conciliation conference only to find the conciliator didn't know that you're in a wheelchair, and so the room, you can't fit through the door of the room because it's such a big one of those big electric ones that won't fit in back of taxis. So it's really important to let them know. I'll give you a classic example. One of our clients a couple of years ago at DJA has a phobia of lifts, and it was really important that when we lodged the complaint on this particular client's behalf that we let the conciliator and the commission know that it couldn't be heard upstairs on level 3 in Lygon Street, because it would mean going up in a lift. So they had to book a room downstairs to hold the conciliation because, you know, without that knowledge, the conciliator wouldn't know. So that's the first thing for preparation, is to let the conciliator know what your special needs are. The other thing, if you're an advocate and you're representing someone at VCAT, you need to make it clear that that is going to be your role. Because normally speaking, if the complainant turns up to a conciliation conference, then unless the conciliator, the investigator, knows that they've got an advocate who's going to represent them and speak on their behalf, then they'll be expecting the person who's been aggrieved by the complaint to actually do the speaking. So if you've got a client with intellectual disability or brain injury or some other type of communication difficulty, it's really important to let the conciliator know that you have that someone representing you. The other thing that I like to do when I'm doing a personal conciliation is I like to sit with my back to the window. This is a little tip for you, okay? So if you sit with you, if you usually the complainant to the Human Rights Commission gets first chance to go into the conciliation room and find a suitable space to sit. I always like to sit, and I recommend my clients sit with their back to the window. Now, the reason for that is it's very hard to see the facial expressions, with a light behind you, okay? So it puts the respondents at a bit of a disadvantage because they're constantly looking to try and see what you're saying and trying to get some sort of sense of what you're doing. And so that's a really good tip. It's a good way of putting the respondents a little bit on edge when you first come into the room. It makes a big difference. It's also there's also a general perception that, you know, people sit around a table and they talk it out. But sometimes it's necessary, and I've used this on many occasions, to actually ask for a whiteboard and pull out the whiteboard and actually draw on the whiteboard what it is that the point I'm trying to get across. Like, for example, if it's an access issue, quite often the people who are responding to the complaint aren't the people that were there on the day when you visited the premises. So it's important that you actually draw out a little floor map, if you like, of what happened to you and where you were at the time and how you went in and so on and so on, as part of the conciliation process itself, so that the lawyer that might be there on the respondent's behalf or the senior manager of the complex or someone else who's going to be there will have a better understanding of what it was really like for you. So preparing for that in advance, having a sketch map of what you wanted to put up there and drawing it out on the whiteboard before the conciliation starts is really important. Have handouts as well, I suggest. That if you have a particular disability, it's really useful idea to have one A4 fact sheet that relates to your particular disability and what the issues are surrounding your disability. Particularly if you can find something from an advocacy agency or a support group or one of the key peak bodies that represent different types of disabilities, where you not only get a description of the disability and so on, but you also get details about how the built environment or society in general creates barriers for that disability. Because in many respondents' eyes, it's your disability that's the barrier. You know, where in fact it's the way they provide the service or the premises that they provide, or the actions that they take or don't act, which is the barrier to your disability. Yeah. It's not the disability.
Now, Trevor, we leapt ahead there.
Yeah.
If I've just turned up to this conciliation and I've made a complaint, I've outlined what the issues are, they've agreed to a conciliation, and I turn up and they've got a group of lawyers with them, won't I feel outnumbered? What can I do about that?
Lawyers are easy. Lawyers are there to represent the interests of the respondent. Okay, so they're out to try and get out of this as easy as possible, try and settle it so that it doesn't go to VCAT. Occasionally, you'll get a really pushy lawyer who will try and force you into dropping the whole complaint. But I find if you just mention the word VCAT and that you're determined to get a systemic outcome no matter what, then that will often produce a result where they will end up agreeing to try and resolve your complaint, but they won't do so unless you have a written confidentiality agreement. Because the big fear about government agencies or large retail outlets or other large organisations is that if it goes to VCAT, it's a public forum. It's listed on the website a couple of days before, that there is Trevor Carroll versus so-and-so, a discrimination complaint. And a quick phone call to The Age, or to the Herald Sun, or the local Leader newspaper, wherever you live, is enough to put the fear of God into the respondent to make them settle. In fact, sometimes I've actually used the media before I've even lodged the complaint to raise an issue. Give you an example. I can't go out at night without a carer and my wheelchair because I have a spinal cord problem and many ears disease. So I can't see in the dark. I fall over. And I had a carer coming out to take me to a meeting one night because my wife was at CWA. And as the taxi driver pulled up, he saw me sitting in my wheelchair out the front with my dark glasses on, and he told the carer, we don't pick up, I don't take wheelchairs and drove off. Now, I'd done a booking on the internet with the cab company, so I had the booking reference number. It was very easy to track down the cab driver. And so that was an example of direct discrimination, where I was refused a service because I clearly had a disability. And that one was that one ended up with the taxi driver getting a solicitor, coming into the Human Rights Commission with the solicitor from the cab company that he was employed by. There was all sorts of trouble. They wanted to try and, you know, force me to not do anything about it. But prior to that, I'd actually rung the local newspaper and let them know that a taxi driver had come to my home and had refused to take me. Well, within half an hour, I had a journalist around. There was photographs being taken. There was a big story on the front page of the local leader newspaper. Even before it went to conciliation, I had the managing director of the cab company wanting to come and visit me with flowers, chocolates and cab vouchers for the rest of my life. But I said, look, yeah, I'm happy to take these things, but I'm still going to lodge a complaint, because this taxi driver needs to know that he can't refuse me a fare because I've got a disability. That's discrimination. So I accepted the gifts in goodwill, and then donated some of them to charity, but also took the complaint to the Human Rights Commission. So using that media, sending out the message that you are not going to lay down about this, you are going to do something about it, sometimes that will be enough to stop it going to Human Rights Commission and it will settle separately. Other times, it's important to follow the process through so you get a systemic outcome.
Now, I want to pull you back, because that's a good example of how you can represent yourself. Under the Equal Opportunity Act, there's a possibility for an organisation where your work intersects with the protected attribute that someone has been discriminated against. So if you've got an agency that advocates on behalf of people with disability and they were discriminated against because of their disability, they can actually give you permission to make a representative complaint on their behalf. Our people on the phones will step you through the process. It's not a very arduous one. It just means that there needs to be a clear link between the disability or the attribute the person was discriminated against for and the work that your organisation does, and they can give you permission to do that on their behalf. And we often find, for example, with families who might have autistic children, every bit of energy is going on that, and to have an advocate step in for them becomes a really crucial way to be able to have that complaint made without draining their personal resources. So you've done representative complaints on behalf of other people. What are some of the things that... A quick short list first. What shouldn't you do? What should any advocate not do if they're doing something on behalf of someone else?
Okay, don't do it without their permission and their consent, because you need to name them as complainants in the complaint. You need to put their name down and get their permission. And so that's really important. You can't just go and make a representative complaint and say, you know, so-and-so Fred down the road without asking Fred's permission. You need their permission and their consent to be actually able to lodge it. So that's the first thing you don't do. The second thing...
It can be a person, an individual you're complaining on behalf of, or a group of people. Mm. If it's a group of people, they need to have been impacted by the same incident. So it can't be a group of incidents that you're complaining about. You can't say this home always does this. It's got to be direct incidents that you can report and ask them to act upon.
Yeah, and I think the other thing you don't do when you're doing a representative complaint is where there are two potential respondents to the complaint is put them down in the same complaint. Okay, they need to be separately written. For example, if I was to lodge a complaint about this venue, for example, for argument's sake, okay, there was something wrong with access to the building, and say there was no hearing loop here for me to use with my hearing aids, okay? That'd be two separate complaints. One complaint would be about the owners of the building and the fact that the access is bad, even though it's exactly the same time and the same event, and the other complaint would be about the organisers of the event not providing a hearing loop. So one of the problems is when you write a complaint, if you put all of that in the one complaint, it makes it extremely difficult for the conciliator to actually separate the two complaints and to send the respondents to the complaint your complaint without divulging the personal information relating to the other party. So one thing you don't do when you're doing a representative complaint and there's more than one respondent involved for the same event is write just one complaint. You've got to put it in two separate documents and they can be held. Often they're not heard. In fact, I can't think of a single time when I've made a representative complaint where both sets of respondents have been in conciliation with me at the same time. They're usually held separately because they're treated separately as separate complaints by the Commission. So that's another good tip for you to do.
Now, when you go into a conciliation with the people at the Commission, they're not your advocates, though. The people at the Commission, the dispute resolution officers, are advocates on behalf of the law. So some people come in and feel disappointed because they've rung, they've filed a complaint, and they imagine that the Commission's going to come in and ride in on a white charger and have their back. That's not what we do. The law itself, though, arguing on behalf of the law can often get a good outcome. I'm asking that as a question.
Yeah. Look, when you lodge a complaint under the Equal Opportunity Act, you will get a response from Michelle Mead or the Complaints Manager or someone, which will not only acknowledge the fact that a complaint has been lodged, but also they will send you a copy of the relevant sections of the Act that relate to your complaint. It's really important that you get that document and that you follow it up and read it before you go into conciliation. Now, it's not always the case that the conciliators will highlight those relevant sections during the conciliation process. It's sent out to you in advance, so it gives you the opportunity to look at those relevant sections and say, yeah, okay, well, this is really important. I didn't realise that. I better make sure I mention that during conciliation. But in my experience, the conciliators don't necessarily quote the relevant sections of the Act unless they are asked to by either the respondent or the complainant. Sometimes if the complainant is asking for something which is outside of the scope of conciliation, then the conciliator might step in and say, look, you know, we can't do that. That's not part of what we do. For example, if during the conciliation process you use breakout rooms, so the respondents will go into one room and consider what you've just told them about your complaint before they come back in and listen to what you want to solve it. And sometimes the conciliator will come and sit with you in a separate breakout room and you might ask for their advice. They don't give advice. You can ask them questions like, for example, what did you feel was the strength of my presentation? And you'll get feedback about that. You might ask questions like, what about the relevant sections of the Act that relate to this? You'll get an answer about that. But you won't get advice about whether or not your complaint is going to settle or not. The conciliators will write the agreements up for you, the conciliation agreements, because they do have a standard one. They will often write them up for you if the respondent doesn't want to do it or they don't have a solicitor that's willing to do it. I like to go prepared with a conciliation agreement already written on a USB stick and have it ready with a hard copy of it to give the respondent and say, this is the agreement I'm prepared to sign, let's negotiate. So we've already got it written, already done there. And if we get really close to an agreement, I just stick it into a USB drive, I'll give it to the Commission staff member, and they'll make the adjustments to the conciliation agreement. It can be printed out, signed, dotted, done, dusted on the same day.
Now,
good preparation.
Just before we go to more questions from the floor, what happens if the respondent doesn't actually want to come to the conciliation?
Yeah, well, then you've got a couple of choices. One, you can either decide it's not worth going ahead with it, depending upon what outcome you want, or you can go to VCAT about it, or another option you've got, which I've used several times, is to go to the media. Now, you can't actually give a copy of your complaint to the media because that's confidential, but there's nothing to stop you from giving the media the details of what happened to you about that. And I've done that many times, and when a respondent has refused to agree to conciliation, and the next thing you know, you get a phone call saying, well, hang on a minute, maybe we will try and settle this, and often it gets settled without going any further to VCAT because you've used the media to highlight attention to it.
Okay. Questions from the floor? Down the front here, if we step towards it. Perfect. Yeah.
Thanks for the presentation, Trevor, and you're obviously very experienced. So we've got a situation within our service. We've been having issues with a cinema that doesn't provide reasonable access for people who use wheelchairs. And we've tried everything that's nice and pleasant in our advocacy toolkit and got nowhere really, to the point where the owner of the cinema has, at the last attempt I made to speak to him, said he had nothing else to say about this issue. So obviously we need to move on to the next stage. We're struggling at the moment, I guess, with trying to toss up. I mean, our resources are very meagre and we actually don't get funded for systemic work. So we have to be as efficient as we can in tackling this matter. And we're tossing up whether to go through Victorian Human Rights Commission and seek the advice there or go straight to VCAT. We do have a solicitor who would help us with that. Have you got an opinion on where we should spend our energies in this instance?
Yeah, look, I wouldn't go to VCAT unless it was a last resort. I think if you've tried to settle this by, you know, reasonable negotiations with the person, then you need to put them in a position where they decide whether it goes to VCAT or not. So what I would do in your situation is I would lodge an individual complaint on behalf of that client with the aim of getting a systemic outcome for everyone like that particular person who needs to access that cinema. And then if the respondent, the cinema owner, refuses to conciliate, then he's made the choice for it to go to VCAT. You haven't. Okay? So that would be my advice, to lodge it with the Human Rights Commission, because sometimes a phone call from... I was going to say Cathy Hobson. Am I allowed to say that?
Let's not.
No. Sometimes a phone call from the conciliator to the respondent is enough to get them to turn up. To say, you know, there's been a formal complaint lodged of discrimination about you, about your cinema, you know, under section such and such, such and such. I'm going to send you the formal complaint. That's often enough to say, well, geez, they are taking this seriously. Maybe we better come to conciliation and try and sort it out. Because the conciliator will let them know that if it doesn't settle through conciliation, it could go to VCAT. Mm. That's bad reputation for a cinema.
Every equal opportunity complaint is decided on its own merits. That doesn't stop the conciliators from saying, even when they're not advocating on behalf of an individual, to the respondent, saying things like, you need to be aware that in other cases just like this, this has been what the outcome has been. And they use it, I wouldn't say they use a threatening tone, but because they're neutral, it packs more weight to say you really need to consider this may not go well for you if you don't consider what these options are that are right in front of you. Any other questions? We're just a few minutes away from our stretch break.
I'll just tell you just quickly about a really successful outcome in relation to a representative complaint on behalf of two or more other people. There's a national retailer, I can't name them obviously, a national retailer that has a habit during sales period of putting all of their sales products on pallets, wooden pallets, straight out of the off the back of a truck onto the floor, the shop floor. And they place them in such a way that at the ends of aisles where when you, if you're in a wheelchair or using a mobility aid of some kind, you go down the aisle but you can't get out. or you can't get in because the pallets, you know, extend over part of the aisle. Now, there were a number of people affected by this particular practice for this national retailer. It wasn't just people with disabilities who couldn't get in. It was mums with prams. It was elderly and frail people using walkers and walking sticks who couldn't manoeuvre around these things. And despite pleas and complaints on this national retailer's website, it went completely unanswered and unaddressed. So I ended up taking a series of photographs then included the photos in the complaint to the Human Rights Commission, clearly showing these barriers. That was enough to get them to conciliation, and they settled. They included disability awareness training for all of their staff. They actually produced a manual about how to promote sales and how to set out the shop floor right across the whole of Australia in relation to this one particular complaint. We're trying to be reasonable, get them to realise it. The bottom line in the end was the fact that they thought it was only people with disabilities that was affected, and they don't make a lot of money out of people with disabilities. But when they realised it was mums with prams, grandmothers looking after the kids, or granddads taking the kids out on the weekend and so who couldn't get into the shop. Once the dollar sign started ticking over and they realised it was costing them money, they were more than willing to sort it all out.
Nothing you'd ever read in one of our brochures, of course. All right. Thank you very much.